Thank you so much for that. Those words really touched me, and I enjoyed it very, very much. When Johan asked me to speak here, I said, okay, that's fine, but can I get Afrikaans praat? And he's like, no. So if my hands are shaking, it's... remember at the Doppers, we only speak Afrikaans. The other day, I had to invite people for some coffee and tea, and my sentence went something like, okay, we would like to annoy you for coffee and cakes, or something like that. So I might ask for some help along the way. But it is a big privilege being here, and I hope really that we will go away here and just know something more about God and ourselves. Can I ask us, please close our eyes, and I just pray for us. Father, thank you so much that we can listen out of your word. We ask you, guide us. Lead us and reveal yourself to us. And Jesus, help us to truly see you, to truly experience you, so that we can honor you. Amen. Today, it's a very long piece that we are doing out of Scripture, exactly one verse. But the question tonight is, the statement that the theme makes is, why most of us are pagans. And this theme really made me think, the reason being is there has to be some disclaimers. Firstly, when I say us, I'm not talking about Christians. I'm talking about humanity, humans. And I thought afterwards, maybe the sentence, why most of us are pagans, is a little arrogant. But I do think when we're finished through going through everything, you'll see where I'm getting from. Now, the word paganism, for those who doesn't know it, basically means that you worship something in the created order and not the creator. Does that make sense? It's a very... is 'n eenvoudige definisie wat ek nou gee, but it boils to that. So you worship something in the created order and not the creator. And here's our verse for tonight. Can we go there? It's Genesis 1 verse 26. Then God said, let us make man in our image according to our likeness. They will rule the fish in the sea, the birds in the sky, the livestock, all the earth, and the creatures that crawl on the earth. It's one verse, but in a certain sense, the whole Bible message is about this verse. It's such a deep verse. Now, the first point I want to talk to you tonight is about identity. My biggest struggle in my life has been about identity. You know, the identity questions. Who am I? Why am I here? At the Reformed God people, we would say roeping, calling. What's my calling? And this has been an intense struggle for a little bit more than 34 years for me now. So it's to me, this is very personal. And at one stage, I realized, but if I wanted to find out who am I, why am I here, I actually needed to go and see what does God say. And in this verse, we get the start of any conversation that you need to have with identity. Because in this verse, God gives us the reason why we were created. He gives us our purpose in life. And it's all in the word image. Now, the Hebrew that is used there is Selem Elohim. Selem Elohim, image of God. Afrikaans beeld van God, Selem Elohim. And what that word means, Selem, it means that that the people were created to firstly represent God on earth, and secondly, to reflect Him. That is our main purpose, to represent God on earth and to reflect Him. And where it comes from is if you go see, and in ancient times, they'd have these Caesarean kings. And these guys, what they said is, when they worship their gods, they would always see the king as a representative. But what the king would do is he would put a statue of himself in the temple to reflect this representation. And what you would find is in their kingdoms, a lot of the time there would be statues of these kings. And what that statue said is, this is Piet Pompies' kingdom. You know, this is guy's place of authority. And in the same way, Genesis 1 wants to say that we represent God and we reflect Him. Now, here's the thing about being a reflection. A reflection is always dependent on the original. Always. And just to, a stupid example, if you go into a mirror, you will see your reflection. But I mean, a mirror can't reflect itself. So a reflection is always dependent on the original. And that brings us to our second point. Where did it go wrong? Because obviously we see in Genesis 3 how man decides, listen here, I don't want to be a reflection of God. I don't want to represent God. I want to represent myself. But now we sit with a problem, because a reflection can't reflect itself. It will always reflect something else. That is the reason why we created. That is our purpose. And what is fascinating, if you go, just look at the language in the Bible, you will find this word, Selem Elohim. You will find that the Bible uses it in the positive way up to Genesis 9. And from there on in the Old Testament, it's gone. In the positive sense. Because from there on, you find the concept of idolatry. Idolatry coming to the fourth. And what happens with idolatry is actually a fascinating thing. And that's what we find in Exodus 32. If you can go. Now, I'm sure you all know the story of this. Can you guys see it well there? It's a story of the golden calf. Does everybody know the story? Okay, I'm just going to run through the story quite fast. But to understand the story, you have to go to Genesis 20. In Genesis 20, God comes and He gives the law to His people. And the first part of the law that He says is, there's only one God, and you might not create an image of Him. Now that's interesting. Why would God tell His people that you may serve no other gods and not create an image of them if there are no other gods? Because the Bible claims there's only one God. There's one omnipotent God. There's no other gods. There isn't a pantheon of gods, you know, who's in competition with Him. And the reason why the Bible claims that is because God knew that the moment that man stepped away from Him, that on that moment our hearts became corrupted. And in that moment our hearts became a factory of idols. And it doesn't matter where we go, because we are created to image and to reflect and to represent, we will always find something to reflect or to represent. Because we were created to worship. So we will either worship God or we will worship something else. And that's what the story of Exodus 32 is about. So the story begins here with Moses going up at Mount Sinai to is it tussenganger? What's that in English? Mediator between Israel and God. So he's gone, but he stays away quite a while. And you see Israel becoming scared. And then at one stage, Israel is really beginning to panic, because firstly, they can't see God. And secondly, the guy who led them out of Egypt is gone. And they don't know where's this guy. And what you must remember is these guys were slaves for hundreds of years. Their identity is slaves. So they are thinking, how is this God going to protect us in the wilderness? Where's the man that actually, you know, led us to up this point? This guy's gone. And then they did an interesting thing, because they defaulted to what they would normally do and what they knew. And that was, they went to Aaron and said, let's make a calf and call that our God. Let's do that. Because they knew this, obviously, from the Egyptians. The Egyptians had a lot of images and things and which they worshipped. And so they said, let's take this calf, let's make it, and then we will worship this. And this will be our God, and this will protect us. And as soon as I read that, I thought, like, yeah, these guys are so stupid. Because it hasn't been long. They've seen all the 10 plagues. They've just gone through the Red Sea. They've seen all these mighty acts. They've seen how God appears in the clouds and the thunders and everything on top of Sinai. And it's just like this. And they're wondering, where's my security? No, where's the one that's going to protect me? But when I thought about it a while, I started realizing we do it too. There's so many times in our lives that we actually do the same thing. Because when we get stuck in a difficult situation, it's almost as if we're always wondering, but how's God going to protect me in this situation? And then we run to different things to find our security, our meaning, and our happiness. We run to different things. To some people, it's money. To other people, it's their job. To some people, it's family. And we start creating idols of these things. And just to get back to the story, what happens next is they have this idol, and God and Moses is speaking, and God gets furious. So he sends Moses down the mountain. And obviously, when Moses comes down there, you see he's basically seeing the biggest orgy party you can think about. You know, it's a mess, but the guys are loving it and going big. And he gets so furious that he breaks the tablets. And what he does is he takes this calf, he melts it down, he grinds it to a fine puer, a fine powder. And what he does with the powder is he throws it in the water and he forces Israel to drink the water. And the reason for that is he's symbolizing something. He's showing them, you become what you worship. You become like what you worship. You are literally taking in this calf that you worshipped, and you are becoming like this calf. And then he uses the phrase, and I think a lot of us knows this phrase. He says, you have eyes that can't see, you have ears that can't hear, you have a stiff neck and a hard heart. And the reason we know this phrase is because all the prophets later on kept using this when they referred to idolatry. They kept grabbing back at this Exodus moment and telling the people, just like Israel there, you have eyes that can't see, ears that can't hear, stiff neck and a hard heart. You become what you worship. Because you were created to represent and reflect. So you will always become what you worship. And quite interesting is that somebody told me the other day, yeah, Chris, but we don't, ons aan bid nie meer beeldjies nie. We don't have like little images, statues that we have, and we don't fall down to the river and, oh, mighty river, and we don't worship the sun or the moon anymore. But the thing is, we don't do those things, but we've just changed the idols. Because what was interesting when I looked at the next pictures, I found that we also have a golden calf. I don't know who knows where this calf is. It's in front of Wall Street, ironically. But the point that I want to make here is that we have different idols. Some of us tries to find our security, our happiness, our meaning, like I said, in our work. Some of us tries to do it with money. Other people try to do it through living a life of bliss. Some people, family. If you're a big family, I'm a big family guy. But there's a big risk that you might idolize your family. And the hard part is that these idols destroy us. Hulle vernietig ons. Because the thing is, these idols make promises that they can't keep. These idols come to us and say, listen here, I will give you security. I will give you meaning. I will give you, make you happy. But it can't deliver on the promise. Why? Because there's nothing. The idol isn't alive. The idol will actually just keep on destroying you. And that's where Paul, when he writes Romans 1, he comes to this conclusion. He says, the worst thing that can happen to you is that God, as God jou net oorgee aan jou begeertes. What's that? As if he just, he gives you over to your desires. That's the worst thing that can happen to you, because it will destroy you. And as I thought about this, I thought, but is it really true? And I started thinking about places in my own life or people in my own life that I've seen. And I started reading, this is really true. Idols does destroy us. Because, just for example, a lot of people, when they read the Old Testament, they read these heathen groups of people who sacrifice their children to their gods. And they go like, whoa, that's terrible. But I can't tell you how many people today are sacrificing their children on the altars of work, of success, of status. I used to do ministry in Witbank, and that's a story of its own. But there's a guy in Witbank who was a very successful man. And his son was about 16 years old. And when you talk to the guy about his son, he would start crying. And he would tell you, you know what? The only time my son wants to speak with me is when he asks for money. Now, when you go into that child's bedroom, you will see about 200,000 rands worth of stuff in there. But the point is, this guy sacrificed his relationship with his child. He sacrificed his child on the altar of success, of work. And he paid the price. When I started working, I started working on the Andela beers. Help me out. Sorry? Stock exchange. I started working on the stock exchange, and I was quite a while there. But I started working there in March of 2008. Now, I don't know if you can remember what happened in about October that year of 2008. Okay, so I see here's a couple of guys who know what happened there. Now, that was a very interesting period of time, because just before the crash, everybody was gunning for it. Everybody was like, let's go, let's go, let's go. Buy more houses, take more loans, you know, just get as much. And I can remember the stock exchange was as high as it ever was. And then there came these sounds that the guys said, listen here, guys, there's a recession going. And I can remember we would sit there and the guys would do everything in their power to convince us, no, there's no recession coming. And then the recession came, the crash came. And the sad part is, there were some of the people who found their identity in their money. And when the recession hit, they couldn't handle it, and they killed themselves. They couldn't handle losing what they worshipped. And so in my life, I saw things like that. You know, I had these experiences, and I realized this is what the Bible is talking about. It's true. Your idols will destroy you. And just to make it a little more personal, I had to reflect on my own life. And I suddenly realized that there's a couple of idols I can see in my own life, which I'm trying to break down, but they're there. And the one is, I really have a groot nood vir aanvaarding, of a behoefte vir aanvaarding. What is that? Acceptance. I've got a big need for acceptance. And so through my life, I would do stupid things, you know. I would do irrational things just to get accepted by people. And then later words, I would say, oh, Lord, I'm so sorry. Oh, that's stupid. But the point is, that was my idol. And it didn't give me happiness. Because what I needed to realize is the only one that needs to accept me is God. That's the only one. So you know, these things become personal, and they really, and why do, now we come to the theme. Why most of us are pagans? What this basically says is, your actions, your dade verklap wat jy aanbid. Your actions reveal what you worship, because you reflect. And that starts to become scary, right? Especially if you look around in our culture. If I look around in our culture, I see a couple of things. I see materialism being reflected everywhere in our Western culture. I see it reflected. I see it reflected in my own life, and that scares me, because we find our security not in God, but in the things we own. If I look around, especially with me as being Afrikaner, I see nationalism of language, culture, being a very big thing, being reflected, and I'm thinking, ouch. How did it happen that culture became our idol? When Paul writes, he says, "Do you know what? For Christ, I'm willing to sacrifice everything. I'm willing to sacrifice language. I'm willing to sacrifice culture. Those things that meant a lot to me means nothing now. Just as long as I can know Christ more." So there's a lot of stuff, and that it's being reflected. And that would make us, if we just look at what we reflect, that we might acknowledge the statement that most of us might be pagans. Most of us might be worshiping, actually. We say we worship God, we say we follow Jesus, but we're actually reflecting something else. And that's a scary statement to me as well. But the message doesn't end here. Because the thing is, there's always good news. The Bible is a good news story. The gospel means good news. And the good news is that, I'm just going to stand like this, so that everybody can see this. The good news is that God doesn't leave us there. He doesn't stop the story and say, listen, you're worthless trash. I'm never going to do anything about it. You know, you were created in my image, but you're not reflecting me, you're not representing me, so now I'm destroying you. No, no, no. He does just the opposite. He says, do you know what? I love man. I love people. So I'm going to send my son as the true image of God. And we see it in a lot of texts. If you would just read with me, the first one there. 2 Corinthians 4 verse 4. Regarding them, the God of this age has blinded the minds of the unbelievers, so they cannot see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. Next one. He is the image of the invisible God. Colossians 1 verse 15. Next one. John 1 verse 18. No one has ever seen God, the one and only Son, the one who is at the Father's side. He has revealed him. So what happens is, throughout the whole New Testament, this image language actually starts to reappear. The Greek word that you use there is eikon, meaning image. And the favorite term that Jesus used to call himself was, I am the Son of Man. Now, where that term comes from is Daniel 7. In Daniel 7, you see this divine messianic figure that represents humanity. So God sent his Son as the true image of God to come make things right again. To turn the image back into the true image. And it is quite interesting, if you read the next of a lot of the other New Testament pieces, you will find that especially Paul uses the language which he says, Jesus is the second Adam. Because just like the first Adam represented humanity, Jesus is the second Adam, and he's representing humanity. Just like the first Adam, what happened to him had certain consequences for everyone. The same with Jesus. And that's why when he dies on the cross, when he pays for our sins, and when he's resurrected out of the grave, it has deep implications for us. Because that means in him, we start being the image of God again. In him, we are actually learning what it is to be human again. Now, just think about that statement for a while. Our humanness was destroyed with the fall. Because we just keep on reflecting dead idols. But Jesus comes and says, listen here, if you want true life, if you want a full life, if you want a life and true security, true meaning, true happiness, you'll find it in me. Because I am the Son of Man. I am the true image. And that's good news. That's great news. And what's wonderful is, obviously, if you read Revelations, I think it's Revelations 1 verse 13, then Jesus is also speaking as the Son of Man. And he's saying that one day he will return and he will finish what he started on that wonderful Sunday when he got resurrected. He will redeem everything, create a new world where there will be no pain, no more suffering. Everything that has gone wrong, he will rectify. And everybody who is in him, who is the true image of God, will live in eternity with him. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I'm looking forward to meeting Jesus in person. Actually spending time with him, person to person, for eternity, I think is going to be a blast. And that's why this is good news. And that's why the other thing is, and I'm ending with this, that's where there's also a test for us. And the test is, what are you reflecting in your life? Are you reflecting more of Jesus? Because that's what the New Testament also says. It says the more we follow him, the more we worship him, because we are then becoming again more and more the image of God. So the more we follow him, we will actually start reflecting him, representing him. Can people see Jesus in you? Or do they see other things? Do they see that you seek your security, your meaning, and your happiness in other things? And I can't answer this question for you guys. I know this just forced me to really look into my life and to say, what is my life reflecting? You know, because I want to be a good image of God. I want to be a good representative. I want to reflect Jesus to the world, even though I'm still a sinner. So yeah, that's the question. And that's the message for tonight. I believe there's a Q&A now. I don't know if my message was too short that you are not, dat julle gewoond is nie. Iemand het net nou reg vir my gesê, Chris, jy kan oor enigiets spreek, net nie oor 20 minute nie.
Any questions? Vraan Afrikaans, van jou nie. James, even you can vraan Afrikaans.
When you talked about idols, I just remembered something that I've read in my studies, and that is in ancient times, we're talking about before 2000 BC, actually earlier than that, before 2300 BC, scholars do not think that there were actually any cult images inside the temples. But that changed in the Akkadian period, when the Akkadian king Sargon I and then his grandson Naram Sin was deified as God while he was still alive. And the practice of placing cult images in the temples representing the God was actually used to represent the human figure of Naram Sin. And that links with what you said, that basically what these people worshipped were not God, but the created creature.
No, exactly. Thank you for that.
Something I saw up on the wall there was Let us make man. Who's us?
I can only speak from my viewpoint, but I believe it's a Trinity speaking there. Because there are different points of view, actually, on who's that us. But I think most of the scholars I've looked up will agree that it's the Trinity speaking there. And it's actually quite interesting because you find something of unity and diversity. Because God speaks as a singular enkelvoud, and you see also the plural playing out there.
Sorry. Thanks, Chris. That was a really good sermon and also opened up a few things for me. But I just want to find out or actually get your point of view on the thing is that I understand the whole Old Testament and then obviously Jesus coming back and, you know, the sanctification and everything that takes place. But, I mean, we might still have all these idols and things in our lives. But, I mean, how do you set a barrier? You know, how do you know when, you know, I mean, because we are faced with these things every day of our lives. I mean, every person has a cell phone. Every person, you know, does something in their life, you know, that, I mean, how do you know when, listen, I'm working out too much. It's becoming an idol. You know, when do you know I am, you know, doing something too much that it is literally an idol now in my life, you know? And so I don't know if I put it clear enough for you, but, yeah. You know.
I think that's an excellent question because it's a challenge, right? I mean, we're called to be in this world. We're not called to, you know, gather there on a mountaintop somewhere and not partaking in culture and with technology. Maybe three quick things. First thing is, I think every now and then it's good for us to reflect on my relationship with God. Is the things I'm using starting to become more important for me than Jesus is? Now, that's a good question to reflect on. I think the second thing is, the second question you should reflect on is, am I bearing the fruit of Jesus in my life? It's interesting, if you read John 15 from verse 1 to 8, Jesus talks to his disciples and he says, anyone who's in me will bear my fruit. If you are in Jesus, it's a oorsake gevolgding, it's a consequence. And I mean, to see what the fruit is, you can only go look at Galatians 5, the fruit of the Spirit. But the reason I'm saying this is a good question to ask is, in my life, if I'm not showing the fruit of the Spirit, John 15 would say, then I probably have idols in my life. Because the big thing is that we will show the fruit of Jesus if we follow him. So that's two questions I think we can use to help us navigate through the sea and through the turbulence. Third thing, I think what is very important for us is to know exactly what are our priorities in life. And I learned a big lesson out of the story of Abraham and Isaac. You know, the one thing that Abraham wanted the most was descendants. So the thing he wanted the most was a son. I mean, he was even willing to leave everything for the promise of a son. And when he gets the son, you see that he is in a very big danger of actually idolizing Isaac. And then God tells him that weird story. Go, listen, yeah, Abram, go sacrifice your son. But the nice thing of the story is that as they walk up the mountain, Isaac asks his father, listen, yeah, where's the lamb that we need to sacrifice? And Abram answers, the Lord will provide. Now, that kind of shook me because the thing is, Abram had enough experiences with God to know that he keeps his promises. So he was, the only way he would be able to go up that mountain, and this I know as a as a father of two, the only way that he would be able to go up that mountain is if he truly believed the Lord will provide. And then obviously, the Lord gives him a lamb, and he says, listen here, Abram, you don't have to sacrifice your son, because one day I will sacrifice mine. I'll do it in your place. That's a long story, but what it boils down to, Abram had a real danger that he would make an idol out of Isaac. And what Abram needed to learn was that Isaac just needed to be in the right priority in his life. So Isaac moest die regte prioriteit. God didn't take Isaac away from him, but he wanted Abram to see, listen here, he needs to be in the right place. And I think with everything we do, technology, everything in culture, I mean, a lot of the stuff that we're actually idolizing are good stuff. You know, it's not bad stuff. It's just that we make it an ultimate thing, where the only ultimate thing is God. I hope that answers some of the question.
Hello. I would like to ask you a question about subcultures and finding identity there. I'm very much part of the music movement, and we're all arty-farty, decadent, wine drinkers.
Good people.
And then you have to find yourself as a follower of Christ within that subculture. You have the stereotype of the nerd, of the IT guy, and even if you're not, if you're trying to be out of that subcultures, for example, if you're a woman, at some stage in your life, you're going to become part of the culture of moms, and you're going to find your identity as a mom, and like your identity is as a minister. Mm. So even that can be an idol. How do you find yourself as a Christian within a certain subculture?
I think, firstly, it's just acknowledging that Christ needs to be my primary identity. Because you'll always have these groups and things, you know, who will shape your social identity. I would say one thing on this. I think that one of the big reasons that God gave us community is that he never sends us alone. When Jesus sends his followers, he always sends them two, you know, or more on mission. So when he sends us into the world, he doesn't send us alone. Because if you go into a subculture or anything alone, I'm willing to bet you're going to suffer in the sense of your identity. And you're going to lose your primary identity. My wife would actually acknowledge this, because she went to work in Holland, the Netherlands, Dutchland. she went to work there, study and work there for 6 years. And we have reflected quite a lot on this period and time in her life. And she said, you know what, Chris, I almost lost my faith completely because I had nobody to share it with. So I was bombarded with all these people with all these kinds of views, and I couldn't. Firstly, I couldn't answer them, and secondly, I started thinking, well, maybe my point of view from the world is wrong. And she said it was only when she came back and actually rejoined the community of faith that her faith started to grow again. So I think that's maybe a practical thing that for these things. Yeah.
In response to what Marcus is saying and Peter, actually, there's three things for me. The one is what is it that will destroy you if it happens, or if you lose it or whatever. So, for example, if it will destroy you if your husband or wife dies, then that's probably an idol, you know. Or if you get rejected, or if you don't get this job, it will destroy you. Then that's probably an idol. And the other thing is, for me, where do I run to with my emotions? You know, so actually, in prayer, God should be the first person to know about it when you get a job, or when you or something bad happens. You know, when there's an emotional outburst of joy or sadness or whatever, God should be the first one that we go to. But often there's something else in the way. So it's either, you know, a friend, or maybe if there's an emotional state, it's a glass of wine, or it's a go straight to the gym, or, you know, so if there's something else that gets the first bulk of our emotion, I think that it should always be God first, you know, so that's the other one. Yeah, and the last one is similar, it's just the first fruit, like what gets the best of our time, the best of our energy, the best of our money.
Can I add on to that? There's a lot, I think there's a couple of people that helped me with this. The first question, if you want to find your idols, the first question that you ask is, Tim Keller would say, what is your dreams and what is your fears? If you go and look to what you dream about and what you really fear, that would give you a good verwijzing, a reference towards where your idol is. The second thing is to analyze where do you find your security, your meaning, and your happiness. Right? Because those three things, we tend to find worldly things for those three things. You know, I always thought, when I was younger, I thought, you know, going drinking with the guys, that's where I'm going to get my happiness. But the problem is, it doesn't make you happy. Jy staan net op met 'n moerse babbelas. Nee, dit is so, but that doesn't make you happy. So looking where your security, your meaning, and your happiness is. And the third thing is follow your wallet. Follow your wallet, because our money always goes to where our priorities are. Always. That's just how it works. So that can, I think, give you good guidelines to where your idols might be.
Thanks, Chris. I really enjoyed that. My question is on the mirror thing and us mirroring God. And on one level, I agree with you. So I want to ask you for a bit of clarification, because we do mirror what we worship. On the other hand, it sounds like you're saying that we are empty signifiers, kind of we are personalityless unless we get we're reflecting God, and then we are all the same or something. Or, you know, there's some question there about how do you integrate people's uniqueness, personality, with the idea of reflecting God and who we are without God and who we are with God and how we are unique.
Yeah, okay, thanks. I hope I'm going to answer you correctly. I think, firstly, that the wonderful thing about Jesus is he shows us unity and diversity. You know, if you go read like Ephesians 4, you would find that it's Jesus who calls us, he creates the unity, and then he talks about the gifts, diversity. So, because we're so diverse. And the second thing is, God has created all cultures in this world, and it's vastly diverse. When you read Revelation 7, then there doesn't stand, everybody looked the same, and it was one culture. There's only means all the people of all nations, volke, tale, were there. So I think we've got a big scope of celebrating diversity, of celebrating actually that your biggest difference from me is your greatest service to me, because that's where I learn. And then maybe also just to add something to, because if I got this wrong, then I apologize for that, but I don't think we are ever empty in the sense of being in an empty vessel. I think God create. What my take on that is that God creates us to represent and to reflect. That is our purpose. Ons bestaansdoel. So what happens is I will either reflect and represent Him, or I will reflect and represent something else. Because we will always seek to fill the void. And Paul also talks about that in Romans 1. You know that our hearts, we yearn to represent and to reflect, because that's why we were created. So I hope that helps a bit.
Yes. Hello. I want to add a comment on Harman's question. I think Lewis gives a brilliant analogy in one of his books. I think actually it is Mere Christianity. I can't remember. Where he gives the analogy of, it's hard really to explain how unity and diversity coexist, because we think they contradict each other, but it's not a contradiction. They actually just like they link into one another. So his analogy is, he uses two analogies, and he says that it's kind of like, imagine you are trying to explain light to someone who has always lived in darkness, and you're going to explain the concept to them, and they're going to think that if you switch on that light, then everybody's going to look exactly the same, because they've never seen anyone. So they're going to think they're going to look exactly the same as everyone else, because this light is going to give us the sameness, but it's not. It actually brings out the diversity more. And he uses, the second analogy he uses is that of salt. If you, let's say, talk to someone who has never tasted salt before, and you put a little salt in their hand and they taste it, and you tell them, oh no, in our, where we come from, we put that on all our food. And they're going to think, it's so overpowering, the taste. Doesn't all your food just taste the same? But salt actually brings out the individual flavor even more. So I think the analogy is the base where we can kind of grapple with this concept, because it is hard to physically explain it. But I guess that is a good way to see at how when we move closer to God, we actually become more diverse, because he, in essence, is creativity. So it makes sense that the closer we move to creativity, yeah, the more we become like ourselves.
Yeah, I would add on to that. I would say in God, we find the source of unity and diversity. It's something along the lines that a unity without diversity is a poor unity. Diversity without unity is a poor unity. You need both. And it's only within the triune God that we actually get this, because in all the other religions, like Islam, you don't get diversity in terms of how they think and how they do. And on the other side, you obviously have postmodernism, you know, everything just being relevant and everything being... But neither of these worldviews, in my perspective, really works, because you need both. And because God himself is the source of unity and diversity. I mean, it's one God with three persons in the Godhead. So thanks for that.
I'm going to stop there. Okay.
Okay, this kind of links to a few of the things said, but I think personally I sometimes struggle with the question of asking, almost like Lorraine said, so what is my first go-to? And maybe we struggle with it because we would like, or it makes sense to us to put God in only one thing, and to put our experience with God in only one method. Because sometimes prayer works for me, and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it works to speak to people, and not only to see that as a means of an idol, but sometimes God speaks so clearly to me through other people, through things that I read, through even to me through just drawing, or not drawing, but doing something that you love sometimes gives me more of an understanding of who he is and who I am with him. So maybe we struggle with idolatry and with the lines because we can't always say that this is an idol. We can't always say that I'm only busy with God when I'm busy with God. When I'm buying a book about God, oh, that's the only way I'm not idolizing books. So, yeah, because the wallet thing is kind of interesting, but now I'm stuck with the question, how many of the things that I actually buy do help me with being one with God? So,
enjoy wrestling with that.
All right. Thank you, Chris. Wow. Thank
you, guys.
Ja, geef me rond a round of applause. By the way, we can make a habit of that. When the guy speaks, regardless of who the guy is, he might be the regular, he might be the guy who always speaks there. When he's finished, just give him a spontaneous round of applause. It's just a culture that I think we should cultivate. All right, Chris, thank you so much. Chris,
had a bit of a fight with his wife, so she's not expecting him soon. So please ask him any questions afterwards. In the courtyard, grab a coffee and corner him for a question.